King Solomon is best remembered for his wisdom. I was interested a few weeks ago when I was working on a sermon about him to look a little more deeply into the roots that supported that vaunted ability of his. You may recall that when the young king was offered anything that his heart might desire by God, that what he requested was wisdom to rule these people. And God was pleased with that kind of choice, and so what he offered to Solomon as a way of fulfilling that promise in the Hebrew literally means a listening heart. I think that is very profound, that the secret to wisdom is the ability to listen, the ability to receive outside reality on its own terms and incorporate that richness into one's own existence. Therefore, this morning, what I want to say is that another of the keys to effective preaching is learning how to listen. Only the person who knows how to receive is going to have something to give. Only when we learn how to utilize creatively our ears and our hearts are we then going to have the right to know how to use our tongues. I believe that profound listening is one of the absolute foundations to effective preaching. Now, before I apply this to the different stages in the preaching process, let me pause for a minute and elaborate, make sure that you understand what I'm talking about. I'm talking here about far more profound reality than just hearing sounds. I am talking, in using the word listening, about that kind of mutuality, that kind of openness, that kind of hospitality, if you please, that is willing to let that which is other than oneself come in, assume its own shape, be what it is, to receive gifts of life from beyond. Now, it occurs to me that there is a deep relationship between two things that Jesus said again and again. He that hath ears, let him hear. If any man would be my disciple, let him deny himself. There is a sense in which we have to deny ourselves, our wishes, our biases, our prejudices, if we are really going to listen. The problem is that so much of what comes in from the outside gets caught in our own needfulness. We have our own prejudices, our own stake in truth being a certain way. And so a reality comes in, and instead of receiving it on its own terms, instead of taking before it the stance of Mother Mary and say, let it be, we take that which comes in and twist it, color it, stereotype it, filter it through our own grid, until what we're interacting with is not outside reality, but the images that we have constructed out of our own desires. It would be like me painting the ceiling with stars according to my own wishes and interacting with that instead of with the heavens. In other words, I would not be receiving vitality beyond myself. I would simply be locked into the sterile process of dealing with my own images. No more nourishing, let me remind you, than my conjuring up images for food and trying to substitute that for eating. Therefore, to really listen is to deny self, to empty self, to sit down before outside reality like a little child and not distort what comes in from outside with my own desires and wishes. Now, a very crucial story for me in this whole area of how to listen is Kierkegaard's famous parable about the traveling circus in Denmark. You may well have heard it. This was a circus that went around from little town to little town, setting up location in the afternoon. And on one particular day, they were setting up outside a village, and about 45 minutes before the circus was to begin, the main tent caught on fire. It turned out that the only person who was fully dressed was the clown. So he was dispatched into the village to get some buckets and get water and get people to help put out the fire. And so he went in and discharged his duty well. He said, fire, fire, to everyone that he met, please come and help us. But remember, he was dressed like a clown. And the people of that village heard him in terms of the way they saw him. They had their own stereotypes of what clowns were supposed to do. They had their own expectations for this kind of reality. And so they thought this was just a new trick to make them laugh, a new way to drum up a crowd. No one paid any attention to the authentic human communication until someone looked on the horizon and saw the red glow and realized that, lo and behold, this was not a clown. This was a human being with an urgent reality message, and they had missed it because they had allowed the word that came in from outside to get caught up in their own images. Well, now, every one of us has to struggle with this. Every one of us has our own predilection that truth and reality be a certain way. And when I say that profound listening is the key to effective preaching, I'm talking about the discipline of learning to turn off all of these records that are always playing inside of us, taking that which is behind our eyes and between our ears and lowering it down so that outside reality can get inside on its own terms, really nourish us, and really give us contact with the outside world. What I'm suggesting is what Martin Buber has been trying to teach three generations of us in his image of the I-thou relationship. This is openness, this is humility, this is mutuality, this is an esteem for the uniqueness of certain of all realities outside ourselves, a willingness to receive gifts from beyond in terms of what they are, rather than in terms of what we are, and therefore really be nourished as outside reality becomes internalized. The gift of a listening heart is the key to wisdom, and it is a discipline to learn to stir up this gift, a learning to empty, deny self, and receive that which the outside world has to give. Okay, having established that listening in this profound sense is at the heart of effective preaching, what I'd like to do this morning is to walk with you through the various stages of the sermon building process and try to emphasize that at each point, learning how to listen is one of the keys to being effective here. The first challenge that any preacher faces is the question, what shall I preach on? What subjects will be the fit objects of my address? How do I decide what it is that I'm going to try to say to my people in the Sunday engagement? In trying to decide what to preach, I find listening to be absolutely essential. I have to put out my antennas in all kinds of directions if I'm going to come up with that word that is really appropriate and really has a chance to speak home to the heart. I mentioned yesterday that listening to my own inner tremors is one place where I can find subjects to preach about. Father Nouwen has said that the better we know ourselves, the more compassionate we become, because when we fish out the cistern of our own being, we realize that for all our individuality, we have so much commonality. We humans are so much alike, particularly in our sinfulness and our needfulness. When I have fished out the cistern, I'm never surprised anymore. When people come and talk to me about their problems, I don't fall in a faint and say, golly, I can't imagine anybody being that wicked. I say, out of a deep resonance in my own being, I know what it is. There is nothing that you have done or could do that I couldn't have done. And therefore, listening to what's going on inside of oneself is one of the places where ideas for sermons are born. Another place is to listen to the times, to immerse oneself into what's happening in history, to be very, very sensitive to what's in the air culturally, what's going on in the community, what people are thinking about. Karl Barth was very famous in saying that the preacher ought to do his work with a Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. And I think that's a very valid image, to try to bring the two together by listening to what's going on in the cultural affairs and then attempting to speak to something that is already reverberating in the consciousness of people. For example, the weekend that President Kennedy was assassinated was an absolutely glorious moment to say an interpretive word about all of the things that that event broke open in the culture. And yet I knew some preachers, because unfortunately it happened on Friday afternoon, who had already finished their preparation, who were so locked into a kind of a non-historical kind of communication that they went ahead and preached their stewardship sermon. In fact, I had one man to say, I wish it had happened on Tuesday, because then I could have had a chance to reflect on it. It was too late. The sermon was finished. He missed one of the great moments of all time to speak an appropriate word. Great preaching ought to be situational. Great preaching ought to tie in to the history, to the moment, to what it is that people are concerned about. In fact, I think that there's a great food for thought in suggesting that one of the marks of God's action on our lives is appropriateness. I heard Bruce Larson say once that every time God touched the life of someone in the Bible significantly, he always called their name. When Moses stood before the burning bush, it was Moses, Moses. On the Damascus Road, it was Saul. That is, the experience seemed to be tailor-made for that individuality. Now, I think that that's right. Maybe what the Bible is talking about when it says that the word of the Lord came or God spoke to somebody, maybe it's not talking about something that is audible. Maybe the mark of divine communication is always appropriateness. Having something happen that seems like it knows your inner core of being and your name is written all over it because it's exactly what you needed in that particular situation. Not long after I went to the church in Texas, I learned that one of the fine deacons of that congregation had been suffering for some 5 years with a malignancy, and there was a flare-up of this again. He was an extraordinarily useful man in the community. He was in charge of the police lab downtown, had 3 teenage children that really needed a father at that part of the pilgrimage. He was one of the most theologically astute laymen that I had ever encountered, a very, very useful man in our church school. And as I watched Rollin Tullis begin to go down under the last onslaughts of the malignancy, it seemed so absurd, so ridiculous, that he should be taken at the very prime of his life and usefulness. And on the morning after he died, about 11 o'clock that night, I came to the church. I was so distraught because I wanted to help the family, but also, here again, I had to face the mystery of death and all of its finality and its ambiguity. And I was feeling a great deal of anger, as I think grieving people do, toward God and toward the universe for this kind of thing happening. And when I got to my office, to this day, I don't know how it got there, but there was a little book on my desk by Hugh Prather called Notes to Myself. I had never heard of Hugh Prather. I didn't know anything about the book. And usually when something like that is given to me and I don't have a reason to take it up, I lay it aside. But that morning, because I was kind of disoriented anyway, I picked it up, and lo and behold, on the very second page, there was a little meditation that I could hardly believe as I read it, for it spoke so appropriately to my situation. Here's what he said as he was looking at his wife of 4 years who lay seriously ill, and he was pondering the possibility that she might well die. She may die before morning, but I've been with her for 4 years. 4 years. There is no way I could feel cheated if I didn't have her for another day. I did not deserve her for 1 minute. God knows that. What I must do is die now. I must accept the justice of death and the injustice of life. I've lived a good life, longer than many, better than most. Tony died when he was 20. I've had 32 years. I could not ask for another day. What did I do to deserve birth? It is a gift, and I am me. That is a miracle. I have no right to a single moment. Some are given a single hour, and yet I have been given 32 years. Few may choose when they will die. I choose to accept death now. As of this moment, I give up my right to my life. I give up my right to her life. But it's morning. I've been given another day. Another day to hear and read and smell and walk in love and glory. I am alive for another day, and it's a gift. That word had my name on it. Just as surely as Saul heard the voice from heaven saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" finding a word that spoke so absolutely appropriately to my sense of anger. That very interesting phrase, the justice of death and the injustice of life. It gave me the perspective I needed for my own working through this grief process. Now that's what I mean by the word should be situational, appropriate, seasonal. When we listen to what's in the air, when we are aware of what's in the minds of people, that's where many of the great ideas come from for sermons. To talk just about abstract truth that has no relation to the times is going to miss most people. To be astute enough to realize what it is that people are concerned about, that becomes one of the places that I get ideas for sermons. And for example, the first year I was here in Louisville, on Derby weekend, I preached about the wager of faith, because that was very much in the air here in the Kentucky culture. At Christmas time and other times of the year when people are naturally thinking about things, to hone in on that, the place that I'm listening in addition to myself is to the times, history. I try to read the journals of interpretation of our time and stay in touch with what is going on in the air of the community. However, perhaps the best place to do listening, in addition to self and times, is to listen to what's going on in the lives of the people of your congregation. I guess Dr. Harry Empson Fosdick was the preeminent preacher of this century in America, and he was one who used to always say that there was no way to preach without also doing a great deal of pastoral counseling. Listening to people one by one, sharing life with them, hearing what it is that they're up against and where their questions are. Here, he said, is where most of the subjects for his sermons were born. And I would say the same way. If you don't have some way to be open to your people, it can take place in the counseling session, it can take place at the dinner party, it can take place in all of these wayside conversations that we have with folk. For example, I came in the parking lot of the church in Texas the other day after having had a funeral, and when I got out of the car, I noticed that two of our lay women were seated in their car talking. They had been to the funeral, had gone to get lunch while I had gone to the cemetery, had come back there for the other to get her car, and they were just sitting there talking. I went over, really just to give a ritualistic word of affirmation, and I found out that they were deeply engaged in a process of grief management of their own. Both of them had lost their mothers that year. Some of the things that had been said in the funeral service had really plugged in to where they were. And when I sensed what was going on, I opened the back door, got in and sat there and listened for a long time to what they were saying. And several ideas that I think will someday find their way into sermons were born by that wayside encounter where I took the time to listen to what was going on. You don't have to be in a structured counseling situation to pick up the signals of what it is that people are needing, asking, and wanting. Let me say at this point that I have found it indispensable that I write down quickly any idea that comes from any of these sources that I have mentioned. I find that the birth of a sermon is like any birth. It is a very fragile affair. Ideas are like sperm. They live only for a very, very short time, and if I don't get them written down quickly, then they vanish forever. So if I'm in my study and I find something that I think has the possibilities of a sermon, I write it down on a piece of paper and put it in my little sermon hopper. If something comes up in a counseling session, as soon as the person leaves, I write it down. If I'm riding around and see something, I try to make a note of it. In other words, I have to keep a record of all the possibilities. Because what I find out is that only about 1 out of 20 of these possibilities ever make their way into a full-blown sermon. Most of them, on reflection, are not substantive enough. But as often as we Baptist preachers have to preach, if you don't take into some kind of nurture all of the possibilities, I think you're really going to face a deficiency when it comes to having something to say on these many times that we have to say something. So I try to plan my work in blocks, seasons of the year, but I keep this hopper where I have listened from all different kinds of sources, and then when I'm planning my work, I usually think of the year in 5 units. There is Advent, the 4 Sundays, and Christmas. Then there's a time from Christmas to Easter, the time from Easter until vacation, and then the time of the rest of the summer, and then the fall up into Advent. I try to work my preaching and the life of the church around these units, and I'll go through periodically these many ideas that have come, and those that have survived, those that have the prospects of being full-blown sermons. Then I move on in the process. First thing I want to say is that in the gathering of ideas, what to preach on, listening, profound sensitivity is the key. I listen to myself. I listen to the times in which I live. I listen to what other people are saying in their agony and joy as to what they need. But having decided what it is that one wants to preach, I move on then to the second step, which is formulating a sermon as a response to this. Paul Tillich called his method of theology the process of correlation. He let the culture define the question and then sought to find the response, the answer, in biblical theological revelation. And this is the way that I would say I go about trying to take these ideas that I have received by listening and try to speak to them preeminently out of the resources of the Bible and Christian theology, Christian ethics, Christian philosophy, in fact, all of the helping disciplines. And here again, I find that listening, the kind of thing I've been talking about, is the key. Now, maybe it sounds strange to you to talk about biblical study as listening, but that's really what it is if you stop and think about it. It is opening yourself in profound mutuality with this body of revelation that has been given to us, and it's trying to hear what the Bible says and find an appropriate way to let this word speak to the situations that you have uncovered. This means that you really grapple with the biblical evidence in its historical form as well as in its existential meaning. Let me say as just an aside that I think it's one of the great tragedies of modern Christian history that the word critical got attached to a serious approach to Bible study. Now, as I understand the high form of critical scholarship, that word is used in terms of discernment. That is, one is trying to take seriously what is said, and one's analysis is aimed at getting a deeper insight so that one can make more of the truth available. Unfortunately, the word critical to the average ear sounds antagonistic. It sounds like you're trying to destroy or debunk the evidence rather than to discern its inner meaning. And therefore, many people, when they hear of a critical approach to the Scripture, think that one is the enemy, that one does not value what is there, and naturally they get very defensive. Maybe the problem is that we have not let our lay people interact with the Bible itself sufficiently enough. I have found that when I can get lay people to working with the Bible itself, they discover the problems that are inherent there. For example, if they're working with Genesis, some intelligent people will say, why are there two creation accounts here in the very beginning? And if they discover that the problems inhere in the historic document, then you can bring in scholarship as the ally, as the helper, and you'll have people saying, thank God for the scholars. They help us with problems that otherwise would be insurmountable. Scholarship becomes ally instead of adversary. However, if we only talk about the Bible and never get our people to interact with it, they think that the problems are superimposed by some hypercritical scholar, and they think that the enemy is the scholar, when in fact, he really is the friend. Therefore, what I'm suggesting is that biblical studies, in the most profound sense, taking the evidence in its historical shape and then tracing out what its implications are, this is a form of listening. And I don't see how a man can do creative, sermonic work in the Christian tradition unless he is always working profoundly with the Scripture. Now, I find that when I set about to find biblical answers to situational questions, that there is always more light here that flashes in other directions than what I have gone there to find. Many times I will set about to build a sermon to answer this particular point, and in the Bible study, I will come up with eight other possibilities for sermons. I am astonished at the bottomless vitality of the biblical revelation, how its truth flashes in so many different directions, and how when one lives into it deeply, one is amazed at the ways that it illuminates this human existence of ours. I take the same stance of listening toward the theological traditions, toward the philosophic traditions, the ethical traditions. I try to read from many different sources, listen in formulating what it is that I want to say. I have gradually across the years moved to another resource of listening in terms of gathering information for the sermon, and that is asking part of the laity itself, those that are going to receive the sermon, to participate in the shaping of this word. I believe that worship at its profoundest sense is a communal act. Something ought to come up out of the life of the people, crest into visibility, and then go back into the life of the people. And I've begun to realize that sermon building is not something that I must do exclusively, but that in taking many people into the process, it will be enriched. So what I'm doing now at Broadway, which is really an extension of some things that I tried earlier in other places, is that we now ask 8 lay people to commit themselves to meet with the Minister of Music and me for 8 weeks. We have lunch together on Tuesday. And what we do on that first Tuesday when the eight people convene is to teach them the different parts of worship, the importance of the sermon. And then for the next 7 weeks, I will identify some objectives. Our musician is there. And we invite these 8 people to collaborate with us in how can we put together a service and a sermon that will be most relevant with this truth to this people. Now, it's a complexification of the process in one sense because you get all kinds of diversity, but it is also an enriching thing. I've been amazed at the creativity that some lay people have manifested. We've had a woman who composed a call to worship, music and words. I've had people to give me illustrations. I've had them write litanies. I've had all kinds of creativity begin to well up in the people. And worship is becoming now not just something that we professionals do to the people or in front of the people, but we're learning how to do it with them. And I believe that some kind of listening to the people before the sermon is shaped, that is, including their data in the richness of the resource that you have to bring to the problem, can make for more effective preaching. And this is one of the new frontiers that I'm on. I'm now listening not only to the Bible and theology, but I'm also listening to my people and asking what needs to be said, what emphasis here do you feel, what resources of interpretation do you bring. And we work 12 days in advance. On a given Tuesday, we'll be working for the Sunday week following. We invite them after they've heard what we're going to do to give material. And on Monday, we put together the service for the next week. And it's really beginning to revolutionize the collaborative approach to preaching that I've sensed for a long time was valid, but never had found a way to do it consistently. Let me move on now to the third step, which is the shaping of the sermon itself. You have listened and heard what it is that you feel needs to be said. You've listened to the many resources that are available out of which a response can be made. Now I find the most painful process is to take all of that and find the shape for the word that will speak to the question. I believe that this is one of the cardinal weaknesses of American preaching at the shaping point. We have many men who have a good nose for truth, who really do a lot of studying, assimilate lots of ideas, but they don't take the time to shape the word succinctly, clearly, effectively. And therefore, many times what comes out are some good ideas, half-formed, poorly expressed, badly put together, and therefore the communication is not what it could be. I think every artist realizes that he's got to have the vision, he's got to gather his materials, but then he's got to also give attention to form. Now, this is the part of preaching that I like the least. I love to study, I love to gather ideas, I could do that all the time. Every Friday is Good Friday for me, because Friday is the time that I have to cut off the gathering of material, and I have to get down to saying, how will I put this in a form that is most likely to be clearly communicated, speaking home to the heart? I have found no substitute for either writing this out in longhand or dictating a rough draft and then taking that and working it over and refining it. I expect I spent anywhere from 4 to 6 hours every week just on the shaping process. It is time consuming, it is laborious. Somebody asked my little daughter one time, how does your father write his sermons? And she said, well, he writes down something and then he scratches it out, and he writes down something and then he scratches it out. Because she had watched me doing the trial and error process that it seems like to me is the act of shaping. But I don't know how one can find the correct form for the word unless some attention is given to how it's going to be said. Now, realize that one of the real problems that we have as Baptists is that we have to preach so often, 2-3 times a week, that you really don't have time to do this kind of careful shaping of every word. I think that one of the reasons we have no more really excellent preachers is that the quantity has simply worn us down. I would say to you that it is very important that at least once a week you apply your very best disciplines to gathering the best material you can and shaping it in the best form that is possible. You can't do that for 3 a week. I would rather you do it really well once, even if it means doing something rather poorly the other times, than drawing down the whole level of what you do so that every sermonic effort is something that is just half thrown together. Perhaps one of the secrets is learning to take Sunday night and turning it into a Bible study teaching. Take Wednesday night and let this be more of a pastoral care approach where you listen to the needs of the people and speak devotionally. Maybe there are ways that we can divide the focus of the services so that we don't have the same kind of objective in all three. But I do think that unless a man works at the task of shaping the word at least once a week, he is going to experience a blockage of communication, great ideas in abstract that are not formed creatively, don't have the best chance to get through. The last thing that I want to say refers to what happens after the sermon has been conceived, after material has been gathered, after the word has been shaped and delivered. I want to suggest that what happens after the sermon has been delivered, as it moves into the life of the people, is also important. But let me back up and say that after I have written out, typed, and reworked the sermon as I have prepared it, I don't try to memorize the sermon. I don't use notes well, as you have obviously seen from what I've done here. What I do, having put it in the best form I know, is simply try to internalize it. On Saturday night, I like right before I go to bed to go over the sermon in my mind, let it dissolve like a lozenge on my tongue, get it down into my subconscious. I get up very early on Sunday morning, take a stiff drink of coffee, and say my prayers. And then I go into the study, and I go over sometimes 3 or 4 times what it is that I have prepared. Then when it comes to the preaching event, I try to simply preach out of the overflow. I don't try to remember what I wrote on the page. I try to get up and recreate what it was that I have been given and what it is that I have worked with. And there are times that new phrases, new illustrations, new thoughts will come in the very act of preaching. And I think it's so important to regard the whole process as alive, never to foreclose the addition of new insight. John Carlton used to say, a man ought to enter the pulpit with the openness that God could speak to him on the first step. The Holy Spirit does give utterance in the very act of expression, and therefore I don't feel bound to say in the pulpit what I have written in the study. However, I think our greater temptation is not to be open to the creativity of the Spirit there as much as to depend on the creativity of spontaneity. After then I have delivered the sermon, I take very seriously the dialogical playback that ought to go on. I believe that the truth is not in any of us, it's between us. I believe the sermon is the first word of a conversation, not the last word handed down by an authority. And so I take seriously the dialogical approach to preaching that there ought to be structured in a way for people to speak back. You can't do this every Sunday. I tried sermon dialogue in two forms. On occasion, I've asked a few people to come to my office immediately after the service. I have a tape recorder there. I have some questions, and I'm not present. They turn the tape recorder on, and they answer questions like, what was he trying to say? What does he expect us to do in light of this sermon? What did I not understand? And then after they have honestly said what they thought, I take the tape recorder and all the courage that I can muster and sit down on Monday and listen to how these people immediately reacted to the word. The more common use of dialogue that I have followed is to state periodically that on Sunday evening I will be at a certain place and would be free to talk about the sermon in any way that those who have participated in it would like to discuss it. And in a give and take and openness, we try to get at the truth together. In my judgment, this has many values. One, it gives the preacher a stance of openness. You know, the pulpit was once called the coward's castle. Men stood here and refused to ever take responsibility in discussion for what they had said. The very willingness to dialogue says that I'm willing to stand with what I have said, and I'm willing to discuss this openly. Dialogue gives you a chance to hear how you're being heard. Dialogue also gives you a chance to clarify where you have been murky or to take the truth and apply it more specifically to somebody's individual need. Again and again in dialogue, people say, you said this, would you say more? Or this is my problem, would you apply it to that? And perhaps most significantly, dialogue is the place where the preacher can learn, where the preacher can take the insights that other people bring to a subject and many times modify his own outlook. In listening to the dialogical feedback of a sermon, I have learned tremendously. At times I have publicly said, you know, you're right and I'm wrong. You have brought to me insight that is better than what I had available. You have taught me, if we really believe in the priesthood of the believer, that every man has creative gifts in relationship to God, why not let the laity teach us? And why not say to them, I am not one that has all the truth. I am one that is trying to raise the questions that out of our corporate richness, better answers can come. Some of the finest moments that I can ever remember in the preaching event have not taken place in the pulpit, but have taken place after the pulpit event in dialogue where the truth between us got clarified, intensified, and appropriated. Now, you can't do this all the time. It would wear thin. But I think two or three times a year, for say a month or 6 weeks, building in the place to listen is of tremendous value. I also think this is a very excellent way to get started in a new church. When I went to Broadway in Fort Worth, after I'd been there about a month, I did a 5-week series on sermon dialogue at Sunday night, and I think that it quickened the process of our getting together and understanding each other, their being able to ask me what I meant by certain things. My hearing the nuance of that particular congregation was a quick way of getting in touch with each other in a collaborative sense. Here then, in a very quick fashion, is how I walk through the different stages of the preaching event. The gathering of the ideas, the identifying of what I want to preach on, gathering material, shaping the idea, saying the word, and then listening to the response. And basic to it all is what I said in the beginning, is the gift of a listening heart. That's where wisdom is ultimately rooted. Only the one who knows how to receive is going to have anything to give. And should this really surprise us, we who call Jesus of Nazareth our Lord, here was the greater than Solomon, who in his own personhood had ears and knew how to hear. Again and again, I'm astonished at his sensitivity to what was going on about him and his ability to shape the appropriate response to the need that he had identified in listening. Remember that time that Jairus' daughter was dying and he was rushing to get to that emergency? There was a crowd swirling around him, people pawing from every side. And as he was walking along, suddenly he stopped and said, who touched me? And his disciples were disgusted. They said, why, the people touching you are, and what are you talking about? And Jesus said, something has happened. I hear, a significant relationship being born. And he looked around, and there was a woman who for 12 years had been menstruating, had been bleeding, and therefore was unclean, unable to ever be close to anybody, family life disrupted, not able to go to the temple because blood in that culture set one apart. One of the most tragically isolated individuals that you can ever imagine. And she had dared, as an untouchable, to reach out and get in touch with this one that she hoped might hold the secret of healing. And Jesus had been sensitive enough to hear that touch. And because he heard it, nobody else realizing it, he was able to speak the word that said to her, "This is not superstition, this healing that has come to you, this is not magic. This is the accepting mercy of God. Go in peace, my daughter. Go in wholeness. Go in shalom." He was able to speak the saving word because he who had ears had learned to hear. May God give to us what he gave to Solomon, the desire for wisdom. And may he answer our prayer the way he answered Solomon's, the gift of a listening heart. Please.